Fifth Interlude, The Mind System. In this chapter, you will learn about the mind system model. It builds on the previous models presented in this book and provides a more complete picture, not just of consciousness, but of the mind as a whole. The mind system model originally comes from the ancient Yogacara school of Buddhism. For the most part, this chapter simply explains that model using modern ideas from cognitive psychology to make things easier to understand. Occasionally, though, we introduce some new concepts to make our overall picture of the mind that much clearer. Because the mind is complex, any in-depth description of how it works must be complex as well, so there's no avoiding the fact that the mind system model takes some effort and study to understand. Yet it will give you a much deeper grasp of what you've experienced so far in your practice, and will prove particularly helpful in later stages, since it throws light on ideas like metacognitive awareness, unification of mind, and no-self. In short, the mind system model is a powerful tool. By taking time to become familiar with it, you will be richly rewarded. The mind as a system. You'll notice we're calling it the mind system instead of the mind. That's because, although we usually talk about the mind as if it were a single entity, it's really made up of many distinct but interconnected processes. This complex system is composed of two main parts, the conscious mind and the unconscious mind. The conscious mind is the part of our psyche we experience directly, while the unconscious is the part that, with its many complex, behind-the-scenes activities, we can only know indirectly through inference. The conscious mind. The models we've presented so far talk about consciousness and the mind as though they were the same. The mind system model, however, recognizes that consciousness is only one part of the mind, a much smaller part, actually, than the unconscious. We can think of the conscious mind as a screen. Projected onto it are the contents of moments of consciousness from the six categories of sensory experience: visual, auditory, olfactory, gustatory, somatosensory, and mental, and binding moments of consciousness. The conscious mind can be described entirely in terms of these seven types of moments of consciousness. In other words, consciousness is visual experience, auditory experience, etc. Our experience of these moments of consciousness is passive. Yet recall from the moments of consciousness model that every moment also has an active component, intention. The intention in a moment of consciousness may be subliminal, remaining in the background, or may itself become an object of attention. These conscious intentions can be precursors to mental, verbal, or physical actions. For example, say that a moment of somatosensory consciousness arises with an unpleasant skin sensation as its object. The accompanying intention might be a spontaneous urge to scratch an itch. Another example is when a moment of visual consciousness arises. If its object is interesting, there will be an intention to stay focused on it. Consciously, we'll experience this as interest in and continued attention to that beautiful flower. Objects such as memories and ideas, perceived via the mind sense, also have intentions associated with them. Say a particular memory from your childhood arises. That moment of consciousness arrives with an intention to pursue a sequence of thoughts associated with the memory. If the intention is strong enough, that's exactly what will happen. Consciously, you'll experience yourself starting to reminisce about your childhood. We often feel like we're engaging in these long trains of thought intentionally. Yet, as you know from your practice, they can be spontaneous and impulsive as well. The intention connected with a mental object, such as a memory, can drag attention through a long sequence of impulsive thoughts. Once again, all moments of consciousness have intentions associated with them, intentions that we may experience consciously as an impulse toward some mental, verbal, or physical action. The unconscious part of the mind system is divided into two major parts, the sensory mind and the discriminating mind. The sensory mind processes information from the five physical senses. It generates moments of sight, sound, smell, and so forth. In contrast, the discriminating mind, the greater part of which is called the thinking, emotional mind, produces moments of consciousness with mental objects, such as thoughts and emotions. It's the part of the mind where reasoning and analysis occur. The sensory and discriminating mind are each composed of many individual sub-minds that function simultaneously and autonomously. Like major divisions within a corporation, each with many departments serving specific purposes, each sub-mind independently performs its own specific task in the service of the mind system as a whole. The sensory mind. The sensory mind is only concerned with information coming in from the outside by way of the physical senses. Within the sensory mind, there are five sub-minds, each with its own sensory field corresponding to one of the five physical senses. One sub-mind works exclusively on phenomena concerned with vision, another exclusively on phenomena concerned with hearing, and so forth. Each sensory sub-mind has its own specialty, so to speak, called its cognitive domain, as well as its own function to perform. The job of each of the sub-minds is to process and interpret raw sensory data as it comes in. First, the sub-minds create sense precepts from that raw information, mental representations of the actual stimulus received by the sense organs. These sense percepts are what we perceive as warmth or blue or a chirp, for example, once they eventually reach consciousness. Next, these sense percepts are recognized, categorized, analyzed, and evaluated in terms of their immediate importance. For instance, consider an external sound that the auditory mind picks up from your surroundings. The auditory mind takes that raw information, processes it, and converts it into a still very raw mental representation of the sound. That sense percept may take the form of a loud, sharp noise. The next step is for the auditory mind to recognize the sense percept, give it a more descriptive but very basic label like hand clap, then categorize and evaluate it as unexpected but not threatening. Remember, this all happens in the unconscious before you have the conscious experience of hearing the sound of a hand clap. Finally, each sub-mind can also store these sense percepts, adding them to a database or inventory that makes it easier to interpret new information in the future. At the end of this process, the unconscious auditory mind projects the hand clap into your peripheral awareness. From there, it can become the object of a moment of attention. Keep in mind that, unlike in this example, most sounds, sights, smells, etc., processed by the sensory minds, remain in a kind of awareness that happens entirely at an unconscious level. The whirring of a fan, sensations of sitting in a chair, or the faint smell of carpet cleaner are examples of things we may not be conscious of, but potentially could be. They don't become conscious because they're filtered out at the level of subconscious awareness. Along with each sense percept, the sensory subminds also produce a hedonic feeling of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. This hedonic feeling accompanies the sense percept as part of a moment of consciousness. For example, the somatosensory mind will evaluate a cool breeze on the skin as pleasant, but a mosquito bite as unpleasant. By contrast, breath sensations tend to be neutral. The last important point about sensory minds is that they play an important role in automatic reactions. For instance, if the auditory mind picks up a strange or unexpected sound, your head will immediately turn toward that sound. That's an inborn reflex. But there are many other automatic reactions we learn through practice and repetition, like when a sprinter leaps off the starting block in response to the starter's gun. Whenever a reflex motor response is programmed to a particular stimulus, the sensory sub-mind involved will automatically initiate the response. This means we'll never be conscious of an intention to perform a reflex reaction. It will just happen, and we only become aware of the action once it's already in motion. As you can tell, these sensory sub-minds are all doing a lot of processing outside of consciousness. The final products of this activity are sense percepts, associated hedonic feelings, and automatic responses. When sense percepts and hedonic feelings are projected into consciousness, this information becomes available as input for the discriminating mind. The discriminating mind. The sensory minds don't project every sense percept they generate into consciousness, but those they do become available to the discriminating mind. It assimilates that information, further processing these sense percepts and transforming them into more complex mental representations. In other words, into perceptions. For example, the visual mind will project a collection of sense percepts into a consciousness as, say, an image of a rapidly moving black and red thing, or an even more specific image, such as a black and red bird flying by. The discriminating mind takes that and creates more elaborate representations of this simple concept by combining it with memories, previous sense percepts, and other stored information, and even things from our imagination. The image of a black and red bird thus becomes transformed into the specific conceptual object, red-winged blackbird. The original sense percepts may have been accompanied by a hedonic feeling of pleasure at the gracefulness of the shape and the combination of black and red. The discriminating mind might then add its own emotional overtones, such as an experience of happiness at seeing and correctly identifying such a beautiful bird. Perceptions based on sense percepts are only one kind of mental object produced by the discriminating mind. It also generates a large variety of other, more purely conceptual representations, such as thoughts and ideas. Emotions such as joy, fear, and anger likewise come from the discriminating mind, which is why we call a major part of it the thinking emotional mind. Finally, it can produce its own hedonic feelings of pleasure and displeasure. Here's an example of how the discriminating mind works. Let's say that earlier in the day, someone called you pushy. After that thought registered in consciousness, it sank into the discriminating mind. Throughout the day, the discriminating mind further digested that information on an unconscious level, perhaps deciding that being called pushy was unpleasant. Later that night, the discriminating mind may project a memory of the incident back into consciousness, along with a feeling of displeasure. When this displeasing memory becomes an object of consciousness, the discriminating mind can process it even more and project new thoughts or emotions about the incident into consciousness. Questions may arise such as, "What does pushy mean? Should I feel ashamed or angry about being called pushy, or maybe proud, since pushiness is a kind of assertiveness, or is it really true, and should I try to change?" These examples are intended to give you a sense of how the discriminating mind works. However, speaking of it as though it were only one thing is misleading. In reality, the discriminating mind consists of many separate sub-minds, just like the sensory mind. Each sub-mind performs specialized activities and has its own particular function and purpose. This can be anything from performing arithmetic to caring for a baby to deciding when a situation calls for you to get angry. any or all of these sub-minds can be active at the same time, and although several may be working on the same task, they do so independently of each other. A closer look at the discriminating mind. Let's zoom in and look at these discriminating sub-minds in more detail. There's a continuous stream of information flowing into consciousness. Each sub-mind only takes from consciousness the information relevant to its particular job and ignores the rest. After the selected information has been discriminated and recombined in various ways, the results may be projected back into consciousness. In our earlier example, one particular sub-mind of the discriminating mind projected the final perception of a red-winged blackbird into consciousness. However, in the interim following the earlier image of a black and red moving object, many other sub-minds may have projected information into consciousness that contributed to that final perception. As each sub-mind acquires more and more information relevant to its purpose, it organizes that information into its own continuously evolving model of reality. When you were 8, you may have firmly believed in Santa Claus, but at some point you realized Santa doesn't exist. This potentially difficult insight forced specific sub-minds to revise their model of reality. Each sub-mind also evaluates all new information and produces hedonic feelings of pleasure or displeasure in response. For example, the sub-mind responsible for rational thought may feel great pleasure in systematically tearing apart the logical flaws in another person's theory. A different sub-mind may produce feelings of displeasure when you run into your ex-spouse. These hedonic feelings, in turn, trigger craving in the form of desire or aversion. All of this becomes the source of intentions that produce mental, verbal, and physical actions in an attempt to satisfy desire and aversion. In stage 2, we talked about how different parts of the mind may have different agendas. We experience this as internal conflict over what to do in a given moment. One part of the mind wants to meditate, but other parts would prefer to have a drink, read a book, nap, or engage in a sexual fantasy. These conflicting desires are evidence of different sub-minds functioning independently within the discriminating mind. Each of these sub-minds wants you to be happy, but each has a different idea of the best way to do that. When we consider the diverse influences these unconscious minds exert on our everyday actions, it's amazing we manage as well as we do. One of the reasons we usually function without too much trouble is because, in a manner of speaking, not all discriminating sub-minds are created equal. In fact, they're arranged in a hierarchy. At the top are sub-minds in charge of things like personal values, self-image, and weighing consequences. These tend to dominate other sub-minds, such as the erotic sub-mind, or the sub-mind responsible for anger. Some final points about the sensory and discriminating sub-minds. The activities of the sensory and discriminating sub-minds don't just determine what sensations we perceive or what thoughts and emotions arise in consciousness. They also dictate the movements of attention. In the moments of consciousness model, we discussed how every perceiving mind moment has an element of intention associated with it. Part of the intention associated with each moment of awareness is for certain things to become objects of attention. This intention may be strong or weak, but when it's strong enough, our attention automatically shifts to the new object. That's why we experience a constant movement of attention as we go through the day. A strong intention for your focus to be drawn to specific objects also explains the coarser kinds of scattered attention when we're meditating. Gross distraction, forgetting the meditation object, and mind wandering. It's also responsible for the experience of subtle distraction, when attention briefly alternates with other objects, even while we're focusing on the breath. The final point to make about these sub-minds concerns how active they are in a given moment. The level of activity of the sensory sub-minds depends on how much external stimulation is present. For instance, when we're absorbed in a beautiful piece of music, the auditory sub-mind is extremely active. However, when we're in a quiet room, the auditory sub-mind remains fairly idle. And of course, all the sensory minds become mostly inactive during deep sleep. On the other hand, the discriminating sub-minds remain continuously active, even during deep sleep, or when we're awake but not consciously thinking. We're all familiar with the evidence for this ongoing activity beneath the surface. For example, say you forgot where you left your wallet, or you can't think of a specific word, no matter how hard you try. You give up and go do something else. Then, suddenly, minutes or hours later, the answer pops into your head. Similarly, the solution to a difficult problem often appears seemingly out of nowhere and at the strangest times, sometimes even in dreams. Dreaming itself is evidence of the discriminating sub-minds continuously at work. In fact, a sub-mind with a task to perform will remain active even during deep, dreamless sleep. This explains why we sometimes wake up in the morning with a feeling of anxiety, unease, or some other emotion that seems to have no apparent cause. Functions of the conscious mind. Here's the picture presented so far. Every sub-mind belongs either to the unconscious sensory or unconscious discriminating mind. Each sub-mind performs its own specialized task independently of others, and all at the same time. Each can project content into consciousness as well as initiate actions. Obviously, there's enormous potential for conflict and inefficiency, if not total chaos. This is where consciousness fits into the picture. The conscious mind provides an interface that allows these unconscious sub-minds to communicate with each other and work together cooperatively. The conscious mind acts as a universal recipient of information. It can receive information from each and every separate unconscious sub-mind. In fact, all conscious experience is simply an ongoing stream of moments of consciousness whose content has been projected into the conscious mind by unconscious sub-minds. Then, when information enters consciousness, it becomes immediately available to all the other sub-minds. Therefore, the conscious mind also serves as a universal source of information. Because the conscious mind is both a universal recipient and a universal source of information, all the unconscious sub-minds can interact with each other through the conscious mind. As a helpful image, picture the whole mind system as a kind of corporation. It is made up of different departments and their employees, each with distinct roles and responsibilities. These are the unconscious sub-minds. At the top of the corporate structure is the boardroom, or conscious mind. The diligent employees working in their separate departments produce reports, which get sent to the boardroom to be discussed further and perhaps acted on. In other words, the unconscious sub-minds send information up into the conscious mind. The conscious mind is simply a passive space where all the other minds can meet. In this boardroom of the mind metaphor, the conscious mind is where important activities of the mind system get brought up, discussed, and decided on. One, and only one, sub-mind can present its information at a time, and that's what creates single moments of consciousness. The object of consciousness during that moment becomes part of the current agenda and is made simultaneously available to all the other sub-minds for further processing. In subsequent moments, they project the results of their further processing into the consciousness, creating a discussion that leads to conclusions and decisions. Key point 1. The conscious mind and the mind system. the conscious mind doesn't actually do anything. Although an enormous amount of important activity takes place there, the conscious mind can be regarded as a space where things happen. Everything that appears in consciousness, decisions, intentions, actions, and even the sense of self, actually comes from the unconscious mind. Even when these become conscious, what happens with them depends on the activities of the unconscious sub-minds. However, this does not mean the conscious mind is just some incidental byproduct of the unconscious mind that doesn't affect anything. Without the conscious mind, the unconscious sub-minds couldn't work together to perform their many different jobs. Executive functions, mind-system interactions, and intentions. Higher-order cognitive tasks, things like regulating, organizing, inhibition, planning, and so forth, are referred to by psychologists as executive functions. Five kinds of situations require executive function because pre-programmed behavior is not sufficient. Planning and decision-making, correcting errors and troubleshooting, situations that require novel actions or complicated sequences of action, dangerous or complex situations, and situations requiring the inhibition of our usual conditioned and habitual responses in order to take a different course of action. These executive functions are a crucial mind-system activity. They involve many sub-minds interacting through consciousness to coordinate the activities of sub-minds, communicate information between sub-minds, discriminate between conflicting information from different sub-minds, decide between conflicting intentions of different sub-minds, integrate new information into appropriate sub-minds, and program new patterns of behavior into individual sub-minds. Before taking in any more technical information, you should be asking yourself, how is all this relevant to my practice? The answer is you've been using executive functions this whole time to train the mind in meditation. For example, when you find yourself resisting a tempting distraction from a particular sub-mind in order to keep your attention on the breath, you're using an inhibitory executive function. This executive function inhibits your automatic impulse to indulge in the distraction. An example of a more active situation is when you intentionally use executive functions to train the mind to automatically correct for dullness or distractions. Over time, consistently using executive functions in this way actually changes the automatic behavior of the mind. That's why, by the time you reach stage 6, dullness and gross distraction are no longer problems. Let's be clear. There isn't an executive in charge performing all these functions. There isn't some sub-mind called the executive sub-mind that coordinates, integrates, decides, and so forth. Instead, executive functions are the result of many sub-minds communicating through consciousness to arrive at a working consensus. Return for a moment to the corporation metaphor. The unconscious sub-minds meet in the boardroom of the conscious mind. No one sub-mind acts as the chairperson to call the meeting to order, set the agenda, call for reports, or accept motions that lead to actions. Instead, all the sub-minds must act cooperatively to fill the role of chairperson. They work together to exhibit leadership, coordinate their activities, and reach a consensus. This is only possible because these many sub-minds have simultaneous access to any information present in the conscious mind. The information discussed by the sub-minds can include any sense percepts, hedonic feelings of pleasure or displeasure, and intentions projected by the five sensory sub-minds into consciousness. It can also include the perceptions, concepts, thoughts, and ideas, mental states and emotions, hedonic feelings of pleasure or displeasure, and intentions projected by the discriminating sub-minds. Remember, although this information becomes available in consciousness only one item at a time, all the subminds can process it simultaneously. It's like a group of board members all looking at the same PowerPoint slide. Individually, each submind can respond to information in the conscious mind in several different ways. It can modify its own stored information, project new information of its own into consciousness so other subminds have access to it, or activate any of its own existing motor response programs. However, it can also participate in executive functions, working jointly with other subminds to create novel actions, new motor response programs for other subminds, or new motor response programs of its own. When you learn a poem by heart, for example, the performance of one particular submind is repeatedly corrected by many other subminds until, eventually, you can recite that poem perfectly, even years later. And when we learn to meditate, the shared collective conscious intentions of other subminds cause the somatosensory mind to alter its own behavior to focus on the breath. Collectively, unconscious subminds use the information projected into consciousness to interact with each other in solving problems, making decisions, and creating new responses to situations. In other words, this collective interaction of subminds and its resulting outcome is the executive function process. Executive functions also have the ability to modify individual subminds' existing motor response programs. The result can be a completely new motor program. Say, for instance, that you only know how to drive an automatic transmission, but are in the process of learning to use stick shift. You'll have to consciously override your old programming and consciously learn how to step on the clutch, reach for the gear shift, and step on the gas. Each of these physical movements calls the activities of particular subminds, visual, somatosensory, discriminating, etc., into consciousness. This, in turn, allows all your subminds to work collectively to change the automatic, unconscious behaviors of certain subminds in particular. Some programs will be slightly altered, others will be changed entirely, and completely new ones may be created. An extended example of mind-system interactions. Let's continue the example of driving to understand how the independent subminds of the unconscious work and the role that consciousness plays. If you're an experienced driver, driving in traffic has become a matter of habit. The visual mind operates constantly, directing the eyes where to look in a programmed pattern of movement. It checks mirrors, looks at the vehicle immediately in front of you, then further ahead, then immediately beside you. Based on this information, the visual mind produces an appropriate motor response. It adjusts the steering, the pressure on the gas or brake, and maybe causes one hand to brush the hair away from your eyes so you can see better. At the same time, the somatosensory mind senses acceleration and deceleration and responds with its own motor responses, fine-tuning the gas, brake, or steering. While doing all this, it can also sense an itch on your cheek and cause your hand to scratch it, or detect some discomfort in your hips and shift your weight to redistribute the pressure. Once more, all these events can take place at a completely subconscious level. As you probably know from personal experience, you can drive through city traffic for miles, oblivious to what's happening around you. You're not even able to recall it afterward. Still, during that time, countless different actions were performed well enough to get you where you were going. You might have paid attention to these events as they happened, but more likely, if you were conscious of them at all, it was only in peripheral awareness. Your attention was preoccupied with remembering, analyzing, planning, or a conversation with your passenger. Regardless of where your attention was, many other subminds kept working on a non-conscious level. This includes the subminds of the discriminating mind. The kinds of information they deal with are different from that of the sensory mind, and the programs they use and the activities they generate can be far more complex. They continuously sort through the contents of the mind, solving problems at an unconscious level. Sometimes they just project their activities into peripheral awareness. Other times, they call attention to things we need to do, such as pick up milk at the store. This explains why, seemingly out of nowhere, a completely unrelated thought and its attendant emotions will spring into consciousness. For instance, you may suddenly remember with dismay an important phone call you forgot to make. Now, let's say that during all this unconscious driving, a trash can rolls into the street in front of you. If you were keeping track of your driving in peripheral awareness, the trash can will immediately become an object of attention. Even if you were driving completely unconsciously, the visual mind will project that unusual event into peripheral awareness, then call attention to it. If there's time. Yet when something happens that demands an even quicker response, you will react before you become conscious of it. You will suddenly brake, swerve, or maybe both, to avoid the trash can. If you're lucky, and without consciousness, it will only be luck. You won't run into someone else or get rear-ended by the car behind you. On the other hand, if you were paying attention to driving and more fully aware of everything around you, your reaction would have also happened via consciousness. The inhibitory executive function process would override your automatic reaction to slam on the brakes or swerve, allowing you to brake more slowly, swerve less, or not at all, or in a safer direction. You may have even chosen to hit the trash can to avoid a more serious collision. If you were driving consciously, every part of your mind would have had ongoing access to lots of different information relevant to the situation. When the impulse to brake and swerve arose, it could be modified by other parts of the mind, resulting in a better outcome. You might even have raised up your coffee cup to avoid spilling it all over yourself. Intentions. In one form or another, intention drives everything we feel, think, say, and do. Intention even determines what goes on in our minds, including what we pay attention to and ignore. Whenever more than one course of action is possible, which is almost always, the decisions we make and our ensuing actions are determined by our intentions. The mind system model helps us see where these intentions come from, why they arise, and how they work. You'll understand why you do what you do, and how you can change it for the better. First, we need to distinguish between intentions we're conscious of and unconscious intentions. Remember, all intentions are ultimately generated by unconscious sub-minds. A conscious intention is just one that has been projected into consciousness. When this happens, many different sub-minds have an opportunity to support or oppose that intention before it actually gives rise to an action. This means any action arising from a conscious intention requires a consensus of sub-minds interacting in the conscious mind. This top-down process takes place via the boardroom of the mind. By contrast, actions caused by unconscious intentions happen automatically. All we're conscious of are the actions themselves, after they've already been initiated. For example, you may automatically let go of a scalding hot mug of tea that you tried to pick up without having been conscious of the intention to let go. These automatic actions arise from a bottom-up, stimulus-driven process originating in a single, unconscious sub-mind. Spontaneous movements of attention are another example of this kind of bottom-up, stimulus-driven process. Let's look more closely at how the top-down process involving conscious intentions works in the decision to sit down to meditate and focus your attention on the breath. A single sub-mind first gives rise to an unconscious intention to meditate, then projects it into the conscious mind. There, it becomes a conscious intention that gets communicated to other sub-minds. For this intention to become a decision and get acted on requires that enough other sub-minds agree to it to outweigh all the other competing intentions. The result of this top-down collective decision is that you sit on your cushion with the intention to focus your breath. As we progress in our practice, we repeatedly invoke the top-down intention to pay attention to breath sensations. In response, the somatosensory mind learns to consistently produce moments of attention to the breath. Realize that the somatosensory mind had been detecting breath sensations all along at an unconscious level. That's its job. However, they weren't projected into consciousness until they became an intentional object of attention. Now, with the consensus of enough other sub-minds, those previously unconscious sense percepts get projected into consciousness, where they quickly become objects of attention. Next, consider the bottom-up process involving unconscious intentions, which obstructs our meditation by producing spontaneous movements of attention. When we sit down and start meditating, it's just a matter of time before other unconscious sub-minds begin projecting things into peripheral awareness they want noticed. These moments of peripheral awareness carry an intention for their objects to become objects of attention. For instance, if someone is making coffee in an adjoining room, the olfactory mind will pick up the aroma and project it into awareness. If the associated intention is strong enough, attention will spontaneously shift to the smell of coffee. Then attention may move on to the pleasant thought of having a latte with extra whipped cream. Unlike the conscious top-down decisions arrived at by sub-minds working together, these shifts of attention to distracting objects come from the bottom up, originating within individual unconscious sub-minds. Many different sub-minds are always projecting their objects and intentions into awareness, so when we meditate, we experience lots of distractions. Fortunately, we aren't entirely at the mercy of these unconscious intentions. Over time, you've directly experienced how conscious intentions can influence spontaneous movements of attention. That's why you were able to overcome the problem of gross distraction. As long as there's a strong enough consensus of sub-minds, you can keep attention from responding to unconscious intentions. But how do top-down, conscious intentions influence the bottom-up intentions and actions of unconscious sub-minds? Conscious and unconscious intentions. There's a dynamic interplay between conscious and unconscious intentions. Think about the way bottom-up material becomes conscious. Each unconscious sub-mind decides on its own which content is important enough to need executive processing, and it projects that into peripheral awareness. For instance, say that the auditory sub-mind perceives an unusual sound that it can't identify on its own. It will project the sound into consciousness as a series of moments of peripheral awareness, along with the intention for the sound to become an object of attention. Once the sound enters peripheral awareness, the mind system as a whole can do a quick preliminary evaluation of both the sound and the intention to pay attention to it and make a decision. If the mind system concludes the sound is important enough, attention will shift to it. However, if the decision goes the other way, the intention to attend to the sound will be blocked. If this keeps happening, the object may keep appearing in peripheral awareness, but it will no longer vie for attention. Sometimes a sub-mind deems its content to be so important that it projects it into consciousness with a very strong intention for it to become an object of attention. If no other sub-minds immediately oppose that intention, the object will spontaneously capture attention. In any case, once the object becomes the focus of attention, the other sub-minds will analyze it in great detail. If it's a sound, for example, the visual sub-mind may identify some visual object as the source of the sound, or the discriminating mind may identify the sound based on previously stored information. The mind system blocks information from individual subminds in a variety of circumstances, sometimes even when an object arrives in peripheral awareness with a strong intention to be noticed. For instance, when we first jump into a swimming pool, peripheral awareness is flooded with sensations from our skin. The same thing happens when we first enter a noisy room. The auditory mind is overwhelmed with sounds. In both cases, particular subminds flood the conscious mind with information, which the mind system then marks as unimportant. That is, we become habituated to these sensations after a short period and largely stop being aware of them. So, even though the unconscious mind determines the content of both peripheral awareness and spontaneous attention, when that content is consistently dismissed or ignored by executive functions, it will eventually stop being presented to the conscious mind. To return to our earlier example, if you smell coffee during meditation and ignore those thoughts about the latte with extra whipped cream, they will fade from awareness. On the other hand, any object in peripheral awareness that gets attended to will continue to be presented. If this happens repeatedly for the same object, or if attention remains focused on it for a long time, that object gets flagged as something significant. Subminds will automatically present it and similar objects to consciousness in the future. For example, always attending to breath sensations at the nose flags those sensations and other breath-related sensations as important. Specific objects can be flagged as important, but so can entire sensory fields. Repeatedly attending to any sensory field, introspective or extrospective, flags the contents of that field as potentially important. Paying attention to sounds, for example, increases your awareness of sounds in general. With that increased awareness, specific objects in that sensory field are much more likely to be noticed. Likewise, paying attention to our state of mind, introspective attention, will lead to an overall increase in introspective awareness. That's why directing attention to any particular mental obstacle, such as gross distraction, makes us more introspectively aware of that kind of obstacle in the future. Yet how important any given object or sensory field actually is also depends on the situation. What's important now may not be at other times. When we're relaxed, an insect biting our arm may seem important, but when we're in a life-threatening situation, it's not. To take another example, in daily life, you want to be aware of the sensory information all around you. But in the context of meditation, specifically the higher stages, you will learn to completely ignore that sensory information. So by attending or not attending to what gets presented in peripheral awareness, executive functions also inform unconscious subminds of the relative importance of particular kinds of information in specific situations. Decisions and actions. So how does the mind system make decisions? From the perspective of this model, what does it mean to make a good or bad decision? Obviously, with so many subminds, conflicting intentions easily arise, in both meditation and daily life. When this happens, we experience uncertainty or internal conflict. It's like when we're deciding what to order on a menu. The salad would be healthy, but the pizza would taste better. The process of deliberating that we go through is basically the different minds offering their arguments in an attempt to achieve agreement. As long as we're in this state of indecision, the participating subminds will keep casting their conflicting votes until they reach some sort of consensus. This casting of votes is, in fact, the executive decision-making process. Although you may eventually say to the waiter, "I'll have the pizza," in reality, various parts of the mind contributed to making that decision. It would be more accurate to say, "We will have the pizza," but that might confuse the waiter. The point is, many different subminds participate in the process of deciding between conflicting intentions. The end result is a conscious decision and intention and a consciously directed course of action. If you're meditating, that means a majority of subminds have agreed to direct and sustain attention on the breath and ignore the competing distraction. Of course, this decision-making process isn't limited to meditating and deciding what to eat. It applies to intentions of every kind, in every situation. When an unconscious sub-mind projects an intention into consciousness, that intention will either be allowed, further reinforced, altered, or simply blocked. Any of these responses is the result of interactions occurring in the mind system as a whole, and any mental, verbal, or physical action can be interrupted even after it has been set in motion, if the consensus happens to shift for some reason. You can, for instance, change your mind and call the waiter back to ask for the salad. Whenever we have to make a decision, there are some subminds whose input is particularly relevant. If any of those don't contribute to the decision-making process, maybe they remain dormant or are preoccupied with something else, it's more likely we'll make a bad choice. This is why people often regret their decisions afterward. What was I thinking? I shouldn't have bought this sports car. I have 3 children to drive around. Limited participation by too few subminds leads to poor decisions. The best decisions come from the fullest participation of every part of the mind system, which is one reason why increased mindfulness is so valuable in daily life. If we can avoid jumping to a quick conclusion, but without getting paralyzed by doubt, then indecision and opposing inclinations provide an opportunity for many different subminds to participate in the decision-making process. For example, immediately identifying with anger typically leads to regrettable actions. But if there's some hesitation in identifying with the anger, maybe because you remember to observe it mindfully instead, then a different result becomes possible. The delay allows information from other subminds to rise into the conscious mind, offering different courses of action. Consider what happens during meditation. If we have decided to meditate, there's a consensus in the mind system for attention to focus on the breath sensations. However, at some point, a somatosensory sub-mind may start projecting a sense percept of knee pain into awareness, along with an intention to make that pain the focus of our attention. The executive function of the mind system, working collectively, can override that intention and ignore the knee pain, even though it may remain in peripheral awareness. Then, maybe a short time later, a discriminating sub-mind may project thoughts about a favorite activity into awareness. These thoughts also arrive with the intention to become objects of attention. As before, this new intention is opposed by the pre-existing intention to watch the breath. Yet, let's say that this time, the other sub-minds of the discriminating mind support the intention to think about the activity. That inner conflict then becomes conscious, and a decision must be made. However the situation resolves itself, it's experienced subjectively as a conscious decision, leading to a conscious, intentional act of attention. You either consciously decide to return to the breath or to pursue the thought. Still, this outcome is actually the result of a collective decision made on an unconscious level by a group of sub-minds. To stay focused on the breath over long periods requires an ongoing, uninterrupted consensus. Training the unconscious sub-minds. To consistently create this kind of consensus, you train unconscious sub-minds through executive processes. Unconscious sub-minds exchange information in the conscious mind, and when that new information has been digested, it changes their behavior. This is learning in the deepest sense of the word. One of the things that makes a human mind special is that we can radically change our programming. No matter how hard you try, you won't be able to teach a lizard to play fetch. The wiring is simply too inflexible. We, on the other hand, are constantly modifying our behavior at every scale, down to the subtlest levels of mental and physical responses. In mind system terms, we can program unconscious subminds through conscious intention so that even following the breath becomes an automatic behavior. Individual subminds are highly responsive to conscious intentions. Even when you're first learning to meditate, there are times when quite a few subminds unite around the idea of following the breath. As long as this shared conscious intention is strong, individual subminds produce relatively few distractions. Yet for a novice, these periods are usually brief. Only with first-hand experience of the positive benefits of meditating, such as greater happiness and satisfaction, will a strong and lasting consensus form around the intention to meditate. A shared conscious intention has a powerful programming effect on individual subminds, making them more likely to produce the same consensus the next time around. This means that every time you sit down to practice, it gets easier to stabilize attention on the breath because more subminds agree on the benefits of meditating. Whenever we do something supported by a strong intention, the results of our actions are evaluated, and the thinking, emotional mind produces a positive or negative reaction according to the outcome. If the result is judged to be good, such as when we successfully follow the breath, the thinking, emotional mind generates a hedonic feeling of pleasure. That feeling is projected into consciousness along with a sense of satisfaction. When the result is judged to be bad, a feeling of displeasure is projected along with a sense of unhappiness and dissatisfaction. Positive effect reinforces the activities and intentions of the unconscious subminds, so they're even more likely to be repeated in the future. A negative reaction has the opposite effect. For an action to become firmly established as a programmed response, it must be repeated consistently and often. The more often the same conscious intention leads to the same action in the same situation, the more likely the subminds involved will react automatically, without the intention first becoming conscious. For instance, living in the desert, I have trained myself to always crack the car windows in summer so it doesn't get too hot inside. The desired result was clear, and the action required to achieve it was equally clear. Now it's become a habit. The general principle, conscious intentions, repeatedly acted upon, eventually give rise to automatic actions that no longer require conscious intention. Much of human behavior is automatic. Think of walking and eating. In fact, most daily activities, sensing external objects, processing the information, and responding to it, happen unconsciously and automatically. This is because pre-programmed reactions are quicker and much more efficient, given our limited ability to process information on a conscious level. Automatic responses result from programs, inborn or learned, that are already present in the sensory and discriminating subminds. Over the course of our lives, we acquire ever more pre-programmed behaviors to deal with all kinds of situations. Nevertheless, we will always encounter circumstances that previously pre-programmed behaviors can't handle. When that happens, it calls for executive function in the creation of new behavioral programs to deal with novel events. The mind system either uses a combination of existing behavioral programs, inhibiting certain actions while selectively initiating others, or else produces completely new actions to meet the current needs. As a result, existing programs are often permanently changed, or completely new programs are created. In other words, learning occurs. Key point 2. Executive functions and the mind system. Every new skill and novel action results from interactions of the mind system as a whole in the performance of executive functions. Learning any skill, like meditation or playing an instrument, involves effort, trial and error, evaluation, and correcting your mistakes. During all of these learning activities, unconscious subminds are interacting collectively in consciousness to create new programs for individual subminds. They can also override individual programs at any time. With repetition, the individual subminds become programmed so that in the future, whenever it's appropriate, they automatically repeat the same activity. In other words, consciously practicing a skill trains unconscious subminds to perform their new tasks perfectly. The narrating mind. The narrating mind is a submind of the much larger discriminating mind. However, it has a very special role and importance all its own. It takes in all the information projected by other subminds, combining, integrating, and organizing it into a meaningful summary. The narrating mind then produces a very specific kind of mind moment called a binding moment of consciousness. The narrating mind and the binding moments it produces are such a subtle and ubiquitous part of the mind system that they are easily overlooked, just as a fish might overlook the very water in which it swims. However, their subtlety belies their importance. The narrating mind weaves the content of the conscious mind into a series of episodes in an ongoing story, which is why we call it the narrating mind. Each of these episodes is then projected back into the conscious mind as a binding moment of consciousness. The result is a continuing chronicle of the mind's ongoing conscious activities, which becomes available to the rest of the mind system. For example, as our attention constantly moves from one thing to another, the narrating mind organizes all those different experiences into a coherent description of our environment and ourselves. This description then gets projected via a binding moment into consciousness. This is similar to the way the narrating mind organizes all the varying camera angles and scene changes in a movie, so that it all fits together and makes sense. The output of the narrating mind is particularly easy to convert into words, because the very structure of language reflects the organizational patterns characteristic of the narrating mind. However, don't mistake the activity of the narrating mind for language. The process of putting something into words is a separate mental activity carried out by a completely different sub-mind of the discriminating mind. So you can better understand the unique role of the narrating mind, here's a step-by-step example of how information is processed and passed from the sensory mind to the discriminating mind, and then to the narrating mind. When the visual mind processes information from the eyes, an image is formed and projected into consciousness. But in this seeing, there is only the seen. That is, the information projected into consciousness is simply an image, consisting of visual sense impressions like color, shape, and contrast. Although certain components of the image may be conceptually enhanced in minimal ways, the image includes no labels or complex ideas about content. Then the image appearing in consciousness is further processed by the discriminating mind, where it's elaborated on using various ideas and memories to achieve a conceptual understanding of what's being observed. The image may be recognized as an oriole, for example. This conceptual representation is then projected into consciousness. But in this recognizing of the oriole, there is only the recognized concept. In other words, the only thing projected into consciousness is the idea of an oriole, along with whatever hedonic feeling accompanies that thought. If the colors and shapes of the image were pleasant, and if its recognition as an oriole was also pleasant, the feeling will be one of pleasure. But in this feeling, there is only the felt pleasure. There is nothing else in consciousness at that moment. In this sequence, seeing, cognizing, and feeling are all separate events, distinct moments of consciousness. The narrating mind then assimilates these events, weaving them together into a series of causally connected episodes. I saw it, I recognized it. I enjoyed it. That information is projected back into consciousness, where it becomes available to the other sub-minds. The sense of self and other. The I of the narrating mind is nothing more than a fictional but convenient construct used to organize all the separate conscious experiences occurring in the mind system. Our very concept of self is none other than this narrative I, the center of gravity that holds the story together. Likewise, the it is another imaginary construct of the narrating mind, a convenient fiction imputed to exist in order to link the different parts of the story together. The truth is, we never actually experience any entity corresponding to it. All that was experienced were the image, concept, hedonic feeling, and any emotion that arose in consciousness. This is an important point, so take some time to think about it. The narrating mind uses this I, it, or self-other structure to organize the information coming from many different sub-minds in a meaningful way. But the discriminating mind assumes the I and the it are actual entities, concretizing the self-other construct so it seems real and substantial. Thus, the narrating mind's fictional I becomes the discriminating mind's ego-self, and the it is seen as the cause for the hedonic feelings and emotions that arise. That fundamental misperception leads to the generation of intentions rooted in desire and aversion. In the example just given, those intentions might lead to grabbing binoculars to see the bird more clearly, or to pursuing the bird, capturing the bird, buying another bird to keep in a cage, or even killing and stuffing the bird for future enjoyment. The earlier sequence of causally connected episodes gets extended. I saw it, I recognized it, I enjoyed it, I wanted it, I pursued it, I obtained it, and I enjoyed it again. Then, of course, inevitably, I lost it, and I grieved. Drawing on stored information about past experiences and other narratives, the discriminating mind also further processes the output of the narrating mind, creating a personal history for the ego self and a description of the world. In the future, perceptions and interpretations based on these complex constructs will trigger desire, aversion, and emotional reactions intended to protect and further enhance the ego self's well-being. The narrating mind then integrates those self-oriented thoughts and emotions into a whole new story, and this cyclical process of reinforcing the ego self goes on and on. In summary, the narrating mind just combines separate conscious events from many different sub-minds into a story, which it projects back into consciousness. But our self-awareness, that ongoing intuitive sense of being a separate self in relationship with a world of objects, comes from how the discriminating mind interprets those stories. Key point 3. Contents of consciousness and the mind system. The contents of the conscious mind are always and only mental constructs, fabrications that come from information processing by unconscious sub-minds. The feelings of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral that accompany our thoughts, emotions, and perceptions are the products of these minds as well. The self and the world of conscious experience consist entirely of mental constructs produced by the mind system as it processes information. Our intuitive sense of these mental constructs as real, existent entities is the result of the discriminating mind misconstruing the narrating mind's output. Emotions like desire and aversion are also mental constructs. Their specific purpose is to motivate certain types of self-oriented behavior. These emotions and the intentions result from how the mind system as a whole interprets the constructs of the narrating mind. The enduring sense of self. You may object to the idea that your sense of being a self is a mere construct. After all, it feels very real. How can we reconcile this powerful sense of self with the idea that we're just a collection of sub-minds? Meditation is all about investigating your actual experience. So I invite you to notice how, when something happens, the I gets imputed only after the fact. Say a memory comes up as you're walking with a friend. Notice how it's only after the memory arises that you turn to your friend and say, "I just remembered something." Or consider how an emotion like sadness can be present long before the thought, "I feel sad," arises. In each example, and in almost every other experience, what gets attributed after the fact to the I is actually the activity of various sub-minds. To make this even clearer, consider what happens when we face a dilemma or have a difficult decision to make. You'll discover that here as well, the I arrives on the scene only after the conflict has arisen. Then, as the conflict continues, the I seems to fret as various thoughts and feelings arise from different sub-minds in support of one option or another. Even after a decision has apparently been reached, the I might still experience doubts or hesitation if some sub-minds aren't convinced. But sooner or later, seemingly from nowhere, a firm decision arises. That nowhere is none other than the unconscious mind. The decision was made by the collective interaction of some of those unconscious sub-minds. After the conflict has been resolved, comes the thought, "I have decided." In all these situations, the narrating mind just takes the ongoing flow of information in consciousness and organizes it into a meaningful story, attributing everything to the imaginary entity called I. The discriminating mind then mistakes this I for an actual individual rather than a product created by a collection of sub-minds. It's as if a room full of people all named George were having a debate, but all you received were reports that George said this and George said that. Like the unconscious discriminating mind receiving information from the narrating mind, you would probably mistake the group for a single, very conflicted individual named George. Your decisions and any subsequent intentions and actions don't originate from some self. They are the result of a consensus among many unconscious sub-minds exchanging information via the conscious mind. Key point 4. Sense of self and the mind system. The basic enduring sense of self, of a separate doer of deeds and experiencer of events, is nothing more than a useful but fictional construct of the narrating mind, reified by the discriminating mind. In other words, the little man in the machine, the soul looking out at the world through the windows of the eyes, and the person sitting in the audience of the mind's theater are all just illusions. The discriminating mind expands on the nebulous narrative, I, until it solidifies into a more overt, concrete idea of an ego self endowed with specific traits. The discriminating mind imputes independent self-existence to this self, imagining that it's a single, enduring, and separate entity. Metacognitive introspective awareness. Introspective awareness means being aware of the mental objects appearing in peripheral awareness, such as thoughts, feelings, ideas, images, and so forth. Metacognitive introspective awareness is the ability to continuously observe not just mental objects, but the activity and overall state of the mind. In the ordinary, untrained mind, introspective awareness is much less developed. Thoughts or emotions arising in peripheral awareness tend to quickly become objects of attention, or else fade back into the unconscious as they are replaced by other thoughts. As a result of your meditation practice, however, you become more aware of the coming and going of these mental objects. For example, with your attention on the breath, you can be introspectively aware of a worrying thought, a mental image, or a pleasant feeling. Then you can allow that thought, image, or feeling to become the focus of attention, or you can choose to ignore it until it goes away. Metacognitive introspective awareness is not just awareness of individual thoughts, memories, and emotions arising and passing. It's a much more powerful and useful form of introspective awareness. In this type of awareness, the narrating mind takes the individual mental objects in peripheral awareness, processes and binds them together, and then projects a description of the current state and activities of the mind into consciousness. These binding moments of introspective awareness provide a comprehensive awareness of the mind itself. Developing this type of meta-awareness, being able to perceive the state and activity of the mind clearly and continuously, is at the heart of your future meditation progress. Just as peripheral awareness of sensation and mental objects was critical in the earlier stages, metacognitive awareness provides the ongoing context for your meditations in the later stages. Ultimately, in the final stages, the mind itself becomes the object of your investigations. Important conclusions about the mind system. Now that we've examined the mind system model in detail, let's review the key points we've identified so far and add two more that will be of crucial importance as you enter the advanced stages of practice. Recall that the conscious mind doesn't actually do anything. Consciousness is a process of information exchange between unconscious sub-minds. Key point one. Every new skill and novel action results from interactions of the mind system as a whole in the performance of executive functions. There is no singular executive in charge. Key point two. The contents of the conscious mind are always and only mental constructs, fabrications that come from information processing by unconscious sub-minds. Key point three. These fabrications include not only a model of reality, but the ego self as well. However, the basic, enduring sense of self, of a separate doer of deeds and experiencer of events, is nothing more than a useful, but fictional, construct of the narrating mind, reified by the discriminating mind. Key point four. From this, we can draw out the fifth key point. The mind system is a dynamic, self-programming system, one that's constantly changing itself. It is the conscious mind that ties the whole system together and allows it to constantly change and evolve. The sensory and discriminating minds, interacting through consciousness, condition each other. Every event, large or small, internal or external, makes its mark. And repeated events produce a kind of habit energy that accumulates over time. The results are astounding. The mind system creates an entire world from its own mental representations, which it constantly adds to and revises. It assembles a vast and complicated web of views about the nature of reality and the self, and through the processes of learning, reinforcing behaviors, and developing new motor skills when needed, it acquires more and more automatic programs for doing things. And of course, intention is involved in all these activities. Indeed, every single emotion, thought, word, and deed comes with an intention. Those intentions mold and shape who and what we are, and determine how we experience events and respond to them in the future. The final key point is that the experience of consciousness itself is the result of the shared receptivity of unconscious sub-minds to the content passing through the conscious mind. Who is it that's conscious? The mind system as a whole. Of what is the mind system conscious? The products of the individual sub-minds that comprise the mind system. What is the purpose of the mind system? To ensure the survival and reproduction of the organism, the psychophysical entity it's a part of, thus continuing the cycle of life. This view of the mind may at first seem reductionist or even materialistic. Please don't jump to those conclusions. They're far from the truth. This is only the beginning of the real story. Our continued exploration of the mind in the coming stages will reveal a truth that's much more profound. The mind system model serves as the foundation for these later discussions. In particular, if you grasp the true nature of the mind system, it helps you avoid the problems created by the illusion of being a self in charge of your mind. As you use this model to better understand the mind, the meditation techniques you've already learned, and those you'll learn in later stages, will all make more sense. You'll be able to understand the more profound experiences you'll have as you progress through the advanced stages. Particularly important are the powerful feelings of happiness and contentment that arise as the mind system begins to work together as a more cohesive, integrated, and harmonious whole. This is called unification of mind, and happens because more and more sub-minds unite around a single conscious intention, the intention to meditate, and continues as you progress through the stages. Eventually, the mind becomes so unified that internal conflicts cease altogether. Stable attention and mindfulness will be completely effortless. As a final reflection, here are some verses from the Lankavatara Sutra that capture the essence of the mind system. Then the Blessed One summarized the teaching in these verses. Just like waves on the ocean are stirred by wind and dance across its surface, never stopping for a moment, the ocean of the unconscious is stirred by the winds of external events and made to dance with waves of consciousness in all their multiplicity, blue and red and other colors, salt, conch shell, milk and honey, the fragrance of fruit and flowers, and rays of the sun and moon. Like the ocean and its waves, they are neither separate nor the same. The seven kinds of consciousness arise from the unconscious mind. Just as different kinds of waves arise from the ocean, different kinds of consciousnesses arise from the unconscious mind. Though the unconscious, the narrator, and the consciousnesses all take different forms, these eight are one and the same. No seer apart from the seen. Just as the ocean and its waves cannot be separated, so too in the mind, the unconscious and the consciousnesses cannot be separated. Karma accumulates in the unconscious through the reflections of the narrator and the volitions of the discriminating mind from a world given form by the five sensory minds. Lankavatara Sutra 9, verse 46.